This week, the Fed announced a second round of QE tapering, resulting with some profit-taking. Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be back with you this weekend for another big show. Well, the Fed followed through with a second round of tapering. At the FOMC meeting, officials dropped the monthly stimulus by another $10 billion for a grand total of $20 billion less worth of toxic mortgage purchases per month. Joining me with insights into this sea change event, the head of Euro-Pacific Capital, who now runs Euro-Pacific Gold Fund, currently the top-performing fund out of 93 competitors, according to Morningstar. He says that gold stocks have bottomed and Indian gold import restrictions will be removed this year, helping to make gold the trade of 2014. Then, 10 years after offering prescient advice to readers to sell real estate and buy gold in the coming collapse of the dollar, in his new book, The Money Bubble, James Turk warns investors to eliminate debt obligations in preparation for an impending global currency crisis. He and his co-author make the case for much higher precious metals prices, setting lofty targets, $10,000 gold and $100 silver. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with yet another must-hear editorial. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather report. Well, on the heels of an impressive five-week gold rally, investors took profits off the table on news of further tapering at the FOMC meeting. Fed governors agreed to drop monthly purchases of toxic mortgage-backed securities by an additional $10 billion, which promptly sent the U.S. dollar higher. In the past two meetings, Fed governors have lowered monthly stimulus by $20 billion, from $85 billion down to $65 billion per month. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold dropped about $30, finishing at $12.45. Silver slid another 75 cents, finishing at $19.17 an ounce. Platinum dropped $64, down about 2%, ending the week near $13.75. Palladium finished at $32, off about 2%, closing near $7.05. And West Texas Intermediate crude added $1, ending the week at $97.50 per barrel. The top story moving the markets this week, the U.S. Federal Reserve voted unanimously on Wednesday to reduce QE-related purchases by another $10 billion a month. An equal amount was cut from both primary QE asset classes. The Treasury purchases were dropped by $5 billion to $35 billion, while mortgage-backed security purchases were slashed by $5 billion down to $30 billion. According to the statement from the January 28th, 29th meeting, growth in economic activity picked up in recent quarters, as seen in the recent GDP figure. U.S. GDP data released Thursday indicated that the economy grew by a 3.2% annual pace in the fourth quarter. However, GDP came in below economists' expectations and sharply lower than the previous figure of 4.1% in the third quarter. Weekly jobless claims also climbed to the highest level in 6 weeks. The report sent money flows from equities and commodities directly into treasuries, the U.S. dollar, and the HGX housing index. In global economic news, the HSBC China Manufacturing Purchasing Managers Index fell to a final reading of about 49.5 in January, down from 50.5 in December. Readings below 50 indicate a contraction in China's manufacturing sector. So now that the Lunar New Year purchasing has passed in the world's second largest economy, the threat of weaker than expected output could curtail gold purchases in the near term. In related news, customs import data from Hong Kong indicated that net imports of gold by China increased nearly 25% in December. Last year, net imports reached 1,150 tons. That's double the previous year. The nation is now officially the largest gold consumer and producer. Elsewhere, according to one media source, whenever a market with solid fundamentals drops 60%, it might be time to build a position. The current Fibonacci retracement in gold indicates that the lows put in 6 weeks ago registered a 62% retracement from the high set in 2011. So, as long as that $1,100 level holds, the bottom may be in place. Speaking of bottom, several South American nations are experiencing currency crises, including Argentina, which has seen a gold bull market as investors shift devalued pesos into the safe haven. Gold has skyrocketed 25% in the past month or so. In terms of pesos, however, in some areas, the peso has declined so much that gold is higher by 40%. Furthermore, since 2011, one source shows that gold has soared by over 300% as the inflation train wreck continues. Bottom line on precious metals. Well known for his bearish attitude on gold recently, Jeffrey Christian, the managing partner at CPM Group, is calling for 1320 gold by late March, due in part to short covering. But his big picture is even more sanguine. He expects gold to climb to as high as, well, 1900 or higher within the next few years. He expects that the Fed tapering has probably already been digested by the precious metals markets, so it poses little threat on a forward basis. In addition, the nascent emerging market currency crisis could turn global investors to the safe haven investment class. So for all of next week's stock picks and forecasts, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, heavy cloud cover appeared over the New York Stock Exchange for the second week running. The Dow Jones Industrials tumbled about 150 points on Friday, ending the worst monthly point decline in 5 years. Market was off about 180 for the week, over 1%, finishing at 15,698 by Friday's close. The S&P 500 gave back 7 points, ending at 1782, down less than 0.5%. And the NASDAQ declined 24 points, just over 0.5%, ending at 4103. Well, despite sharp selling, mutual funds and U.S. stocks experienced net inflows of nearly $8 billion in the week ended January 29th. That according to Lipper. Google shares blasted higher by over 4% to an all-time high as the web search giant's fourth quarter revenues exceeded expectations. Online and mobile device video game maker shocked investors. Zynga, ZNGA, soared 24% on news of a purchase of a mogul competing mobile game maker, Natural Motion, in a deal valued at over $500 million. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, at the risk of repeating last week's report, rumors of the stock market's death, I think, are a bit premature. In only 2 weeks, the fear level seen in our 7-component sentiment index has shifted from greedy to panic. This is the type of figure one would expect to see near a long-term low, something to the extent of 2003 or 2009. So in the next week or so, I would not be at all shocked to see a powerful retracement. And for next week's forecast and all the stock picks, please log into your account. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Peter Schiff and James Turk. We hope you'll stay with us here at GoldSeek. My featured guest today says that gold will be the trade of the year. Peter Schiff is president and chief global strategist of Euro Pacific Capital. Welcome back, Peter Schiff.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Let's begin with the trade of the year, as you're calling it, and the Fed tapering story. You know, at the last FOMC meeting in December, officials lowered the monthly MBS purchases from $85 billion down to $75 billion. Do you expect the new Fed chairwoman to continue the trend this week?
Continues it, she's not going to continue it for long. I do believe that the Fed is ultimately going to reverse course and increase the monthly quantitative easing. It's not just mortgage-backed securities, it's treasuries that they're buying. I believe that as long as the Fed stays on its tapering path, as long as the expectations are for a increase in the amount of taper and a gradual a cessation of quantitative easing, right? As long as we're on that trajectory and the market is looking forward to the day where the Fed is no longer in the markets propping up the bond market and propping up the mortgage market, and even beyond that to the point where the Fed tries to exit some of its positions by actually selling, not just buying fewer government bonds and mortgages, but starting to sell the bonds and mortgages that it already holds, right? So as long as we're on that trajectory, I think the stock market is going to be under a lot of pressure. I think we've already seen the beginning of that thus far in 2014. You know, we came into the year with a lot of optimism. Everybody was, expecting more of the same that we had in 2013. And so far, the market's been heading down. And I think that's going to continue until the Fed cries uncle, until the Fed comes to the rescue of the market and the economy. Because remember, the whole basis for the tapering is the economic recovery that has resulted from the wealth effect of a rising stock market and a rising real estate market that provide the collateral that we can borrow against to continue to consume things that we really can't afford. And so as the bubble starts to come out of those markets based on the Fed's taper talk, now all of a sudden the phony recovery is in danger. And in fact, the economic data that we're getting shows the economy losing momentum. Wall Street wants to dismiss it. You know, we got the bad jobs number. We got today, we got a very weak durable goods number. But everybody is looking past the bad news, assuming that it's just a fluke, that it's just an aberration, because so many people have such a vested interest in believing this mythical recovery, that we're going to have this 3 to 4% economic growth, and that's not going to happen. And so eventually the Fed is going to acquiesce, and we're going to be talking about more, not less QE. And the market doesn't expect that at all. Certainly the gold market doesn't expect that.
Okay, well, that's a good segue into the trade of the year, as you're calling it. A lot of factors here converging on the precious metals sector. China, of course, officially surpassed India as the world's biggest gold purchaser as well as producer, and that's partly due to Indian, you know, import restrictions, as well as the growing affluence, though, of China's middle class. You know, since the government has not revealed an official import tally in years, do you suspect that China may be consuming more gold than presumed?
I mean, they're consuming a lot more gold. In fact, I think the Chinese officials are being dishonest with respect to their holdings. I don't think they want to tell the world exactly how much gold they own, because then they probably won't be able to buy much more of it, because nobody will want to sell it to them once they appreciate just how much they have and how much they want to buy. So I think they want to keep their appetite under wraps as they quietly accumulate as much gold as they can. In fact, I think in 2014, those import restrictions in India are going to be lifted. I mean, they are doing a lot of damage. It's not doing anything to reduce India's trade deficit, and they shouldn't even consider gold as part of the trade deficit because they're not consumer goods. The gold is being purchased as a store of wealth, and so the fact that they're importing gold is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. But right now you've got all this illegal activity that, you know, there's more gold being smuggled into India than, you know, narcotics. And Indians are having to pay a big premium.
Yeah, right now up to $160 over a London spot.
That's not helping the Indian economy. It's not helping India's people having to pay more than the world price. So I do believe that they're going to get rid of these restrictions, and that will bring down the price of gold in India, which, of course, will increase demand for gold in India. And, of course, there are a lot of people who don't want to buy things illegally. They will come back to the market once, you know, they can legally do so. And I think you're going to see a lot of demand coming out of India, a lot of demand coming out of China, and renewed demand all around the world, including the United States, and eventually maybe even the speculators who have sold all their gold. And I think the only selling now coming from speculators is short selling. I think the speculators, the hedge funds, the private equity guys who jumped on the gold bandwagon for the first time in 2011, 2012, they all sold their gold in 2013. So I don't think there's any real speculators that still are in this market. I think the selling today is coming from the short sellers. That's people who are selling gold that they don't even own, expecting the price to drop. Well, I think they're wrong on what they're expecting to happen. Eventually, they're going to be forced to come into the market and buy that gold in competition with everybody else who wants to buy gold to cover those losing short positions. And so that's why, if you want to call it maybe the trade of the year, or maybe even gold stocks, I think they're probably even a better trade than the bullion itself, because there you have an even worst-case scenario baked into the price. I mean, whatever collapse people think is coming for the price of gold, they think it's going to be even worse for the miners. And so there, I think you have some tremendous opportunity once the price of gold moves up, you know, $200 or $300 an ounce, and it becomes clear that we're not going to 800, that we might hold 1500, 1600, or go a lot higher. A lot of these gold stocks that are literally price for bankruptcy are going to come, you know, back.
We've certainly seen the GDX and the HUI indexes overshoot it on the downside, viewed it as a leveraged play on the precious metals. But folks, I think, forget, you know, that these companies have cash flows, added incentive to look for some of those diamonds in the rough. Also wanted to ask you about, you know, last week news of slower than anticipated growth in China obviously rattled the markets. I mean, it's clearly had a negative impact on silver due to its industrial applications. We watched gold leap off the launching pad last week, but silver, of course, just slumped. How significant is China's economic growth, do you think, to the precious metal story?
Well, I think what's more significant is the growth of money supply around the world. I mean, that's what's really going to be driving precious metals demand, is that all these economies, including China, are printing too much money. And a lot of them are doing it because they feel it's the only way to stimulate their economies, even though it's wrong. It doesn't really stimulate the economy. It certainly props up asset bubbles and economies that temporarily depend on asset bubbles like the United States. And also you have a lot of nations, not China, but you have a lot of nations, developed nations in the United States and Western Europe with tremendous amounts of debt, you know, and Japan. And these governments cannot afford to pay a market rate of interest. They need artificially low interest rates. They need their central banks to buy up all this debt, and they have to print money to do it. And so you have a world that's awash in inflation, and so that's where the demand is going to come from for gold or silver, because people are going to need a store of value. You cannot store value in dollars. You can't even store it in euros or Japanese yen. The longer you hold those currencies, the less they are going to be worth. In the meantime, you can't collect any interest for holding them, so all you do is lose. And therefore, if you don't want to suffer that kind of loss, if you want to be able to store your purchasing power and use it in the future, how are you going to do that? I mean, you can gamble on the stock market. Maybe you can put some money into collectibles. You can buy rare paintings or other types of works of art. But there, you know, you have much less liquidity. You have much bigger spreads between the bid and the ask. It makes a lot more sense for people who want to keep their purchasing power safe for later use, whether to fund consumption or other investments, that gold is the most viable alternative to depreciating fiat currencies. And as more and more people around the world rediscover the monetary qualities of gold and appreciate the dangers of fiat currency, that demand is going to explode and the price is going to go way up.
Speaking of liquidity, some folks turn to the exchange-traded funds. The gold ETFs experienced inflows for the first time in nearly 6 months. Now, that's registered about $33 million increase there. That's the best number in a year and a half. So far, the junior gold miners are up about 17%, and the gold bullion spider ETF is also registering a solid inflow for the first time in a while. From your perspective, what does this mean for the market?
Well, I think for the gold market, I think it's great. I mean, if you recall, I launched my gold mutual fund with Adrian Day late last year in the fourth quarter of 2013. That was the first time I've ever launched a mutual fund that was exclusively gold mining. And I now have 9 mutual funds in the family, but right now the gold fund is the top performing fund. In fact, gold funds as a sector are the number one performing funds in 2014. And in fact, if you go on Morningstar.com and you look at my gold fund, right, which is EPGFX, Euro Pacific Gold Fund, Morningstar ranks my fund the number one fund for 2014 of 73 gold funds that they track. In fact, I'm not only number one for 2014, it's the number one gold fund for the last 30 days, which would include, you know, a little bit of December. But and the reason that, you know, our fund is doing so well is because we have a lot of exposure to some of these junior companies, some of the smaller companies. And I think we've done a good job. Adrian Day has done a good job of picking the best of the best when it comes to the gold stocks. And so I think it's still a great time. In fact, we launched the fund at about $10 a share, and it initially went up over 11, and then it sold off close to $8 in December, and now it's just back up, you know, close to 10 again. But I think we're still right near the bottom. We're just bouncing along the bottom when it comes to these gold stocks. And if I'm right about, you know, this being the bottom and we're going to have a breakout, I mean, I think the returns are going to be spectacular in these gold mining stocks. And again, that's why we have this fund, and that's why I picked Adrian Day to manage it for me, because he's been managing gold portfolios for 25, 30 years. I think he knows this business cold. I think he's a great stock picker. He did an excellent job with the private accounts that he managed before I brought him on board to manage my gold fund. But I think it's a great time. And if, you know, you're not in the market, you know, check out my fund, read a prospectus, you know, make sure that you, you know, it fits your objectives, know the risks. But if you're going to get into the market, this is the best way, I think, to do it with that fund.
Well, analysts at Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, as well as RBC, certainly mirror your sentiments, gold positive. Looking for a short squeeze here, they're calling for a squeeze above the 1270 and 1275 level that could send the market another $150 higher. I'd like to know if you suspect this could occur and what might be the trigger.
There are a number of triggers that can send the market higher, so, you know, eventually something will. I mean, it might be either a very negative data point, maybe a really bad jobs number that comes out, or it could be an admission from the Fed, from Janet Yellen, that she's going to slow down the tapering or that she's going to reverse it or something like that. Something could happen that is going to cause gold to go up. It could even just be that the stock markets are going down. I mean, one of the reasons that so many people are bearish on gold is because they're bullish on stocks. They think, well, if the stock market's going up, well, then there's no reason to buy gold, which I think is false. I think gold and stocks can go up at the same time, especially if it's bad monetary policy that's driving it. I mean, inflation makes prices go up, but I think gold benefits more from inflation than just the major stock market averages. But weakness in the stock market could do it. Other problems maybe in some of the emerging markets. There could be some kind of a currency crisis somewhere. I think ultimately it's going to be the dollar that's going to be the currency in crisis. But there are a lot of things that can go wrong. Meanwhile, most people think nothing can go wrong. I mean, certainly we ended 2013 on such a high level of optimism where, you know, Morgan Stanley was just a week and a half ago, came out and revised downward their forecast for the price of gold in 2014 based on the fact that there was no reason to have anything safe, that there was no longer any risk, and that people would just want to buy the riskiest assets possible to take advantage of this great situation that we have in the world, and that there would be no need for any kind of insurance policy, any kind of safe haven. And so they saw nothing but downside for gold. You know, that was just a week before all this turmoil started.
Well, speaking of turmoil and international currency trouble, global currency markets last week experienced the sharpest sell-off since 2008, the financial crisis. We saw Argentina, Turkey, South Africa, Ukraine, Venezuela, India, Brazil, many others listed among the emerging market casualty list. Some analysts are pointing to Fed tapering as the root cause, but, you know, others think that it's, well, just basic central bank profligacy. What's the true culprit here?
Well, it's actually both, because remember, when the Fed was creating all this money for quantitative easing, and of course they're still creating it, even though they're talking about, you know, creating less, but as they were creating all this money, that money was flowing all around the world, a lot of it into emerging markets as people were chasing yield and looking for a way out of a depreciating U.S. dollar. And unfortunately, a lot of these emerging market economies, instead of allowing their currencies to rise in value, they simply printed more money in order to accommodate the inflows to prevent their currencies from going up. But now you have a situation where you have all this extra currency, and now you've got money trying to be yanked back out of those markets, and now it's putting huge downward pressure on those currencies because those money supplies have been dramatically inflated by the central banks. But the inflation started at the Fed, and we exported it to a lot of the emerging markets that imported from us. And now they're suffering the backlash. So, yeah, it is the Fed. The Fed is at the root cause of all these monetary imbalances because the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency, and everybody is trying to anchor their currency to the dollar. It's like everybody trying to tether their ship to the Titanic, you know. Then the Titanic sinks and...
You know, Argentina and Venezuela also experiencing considerable shortage of basic necessities. Also, we're seeing some looting. Venezuela Bolivar was just devalued by more than 40%. And Brazil now, they're bracing for the economic contagion. Could this inflation and related social disturbances, could we see something like that reach our shores?
Well, absolutely. You know, the government now is trying to tell us that the biggest problem is that we don't have enough inflation, that prices aren't rising fast enough, and the Fed has to try to get them to go up faster. You know, meantime, look at what's happened in the last week or so. Natural gas prices up 30%, home heating oil prices up 10%, oil price is now almost at $100 a barrel again. I mean, these are some big, big increases, and a lot of Americans need to buy a lot of natural gas now and heating oil because we're having the coldest January in history. Right? I mean, I suppose it was, you know, supposed to be global warming, but this is the coldest January ever, and Americans are having to use a lot more heating oil and natural gas, and the price is skyrocketing. You know, meanwhile, meat prices are hitting record highs. Milk prices are hitting record highs. Even the post office just raised the price of a stamp by 6.5% from last year. I mean, everything is going up in price except people's paychecks. The paychecks are going down if you're even lucky enough to have one. So, you know, things are going to get more and more difficult for Americans. The president's going to talk about that in the State of the Union when he talks about the income disparity, which is being created by his policies and by the Federal Reserve. And, of course, what he proposes to do about it will only worsen the situation. So eventually, yeah, we could have people rioting over these high prices, right? And it's only going to get worse.
You know, rumors of a stealth bank run around the globe are rife right now with the HSBC. I'm sure you heard many others restricting withdrawal limits and demanding to know what's the purpose of the funds that you're borrowing from us, as though it's not our funds. In China, depositors have been unable to withdraw hundreds of millions, reportedly, in deposits over the last few weeks. Art Cashin, formerly seen on CNBC, now with UBS, says that credit markets in China could be broken. What are your thoughts?
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of rumors circulating around about what's going on. But clearly, you know, there are strains on this global financial system. You know, there's so much credit, it's hard to contain it. It starts springing some holes, and everybody tries to plug them up, and then another one pops up. So, you know, this whole system is inherently unstable. The monetary system that we have with the dollar at the center, and the huge trade and current account deficits that we run, and we export this inflation and bad monetary policy all around the world, and everything is based on, you know, Americans going deeper into debt when they're already too broke to pay back the money that they borrowed. So we have to inflate these asset bubbles and get them bigger and bigger and bigger so we can pretend that we have some level of solvency so we can keep on borrowing.
And as we wrap up here, you know, the Dow and related equities markets struggled last week. You know, the industrials off about 500 points for the week. Starting to look like the zenith may be in for the market. Hard to tell, you know, until we see it in retrospect. But I'd like to know your thoughts on the general equities market.
Yeah, you know, the bad news has been coming out. I mean, you know, we had horrible, horrible retail sales, you know, across a wide scope of retailers. I mean, the big ones like JCPenney and Sears, but, you know, all kinds of bad numbers came out. And, you know, we had the worst Christmas since the 2008 financial crisis, and things were getting better. You know, why didn't Americans have money to go Christmas shopping? Now the stores have massive discounts, 70, 80% off. I think you're going to see lots of closings in 2014 of retailers. A lot of the malls you're going to walk by, you're going to see a lot of empty stores, a lot of layoffs in that sector. Even today, look, Apple came out and guided down. They're not selling as many iPhones. I mean, the consumer is tapped out, right? And he doesn't have any more assets to lever up. He's already drowning in student loans, auto loans, credit card debt, mortgage debt. In fact, a lot of the people who used to own homes, you know, they lost their homes to foreclosure, and now they're renting, and the rising real estate market doesn't help them out. It just means that their landlord's going to raise their rent, and rent prices are going up, and that's hurting a lot of people. So they don't have money to go shopping anymore, and this is now showing up, and I think Wall Street is now having to deal with this bad news. And again, right now, it's still being resisted. People are waiting for the good news that they know is coming because they're convinced that this recovery is here. But little by little, kind of like Chinese water torture, these negative data points are going to keep coming out, surprising everybody until there's enough of it that it's like a flood. And then you have a much bigger break in the market, which I think is what's going to be the catalyst for the Federal Reserve cavalry to come riding to the rescue, you know, with a bunch of QE, right, and give the market what it needs, which is another fix. And then we'll have another rally again. But I think the rally will be much bigger in precious metals and even bigger in precious metal stocks than it will be in the Dow or the NASDAQ.
Well, if your alternative hypothesis is proven correct, I mean, that certainly would be quite a turnaround event. I mean, with everyone factoring in further tapering to see the Fed make an about face.
That's why I thought the Fed wouldn't even taper, because I think they lose so much credibility, not that they should have any credibility left to lose, but when they have this tapering timetable and then they come out and have to reverse it, you know, based on the data. But, of course, they did leave themselves that out. But that's what they've done all along. They've always said that the tapering is data dependent, right? So they left themselves an out to be able to reverse it, because they've said that they will adjust the QE based on the data. Adjust could go up or down. And so the Fed could still say, look, we never promised that we were going to taper. We only said that if the economy got better, we would taper. And clearly, based on the new data that we didn't have, the economy is not getting better. It's actually getting weaker. And that's why we're going to do more QE, you know, that they can say that eventually when the economy is really strong, then we'll taper. But the problem is they can never taper, right? You live by QE, you die by QE. If you build a recovery on QE, you have to continue the QE to keep the recovery going. You can never taper, because the minute you taper, there goes the recovery, you're right back in recession, and so there you're going with more QE. But the problem is, you know, the more you do it, the more QE you need. So it always has to get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Exactly. And, you know, we look at this supposed nascent recovery. For the most part, I mean, sure, we've seen the unemployment rate decline, mostly due to the fact that the participation rate is plunging, and we're still at least a percent or more above the Fed's target unemployment rate. So, I mean, that does leave considerable room.
The Fed has already said the unemployment rate doesn't matter. They've already taken that off the table. And said, look, you know, we're looking at other factors, because in many ways the unemployment rate doesn't mean much if people keep leaving the labor force because they can't find jobs and now they're not counted as being unemployed anymore. You know, I mean, if the labor force participation rate was still the same as it was when the recession began, the unemployment rate would be over 11%, right? So the only reason it's 6.7% is because all those people who used to have jobs are no longer looking for jobs. They're not even, they're just living on welfare or disability, and they're not considered unemployed because they don't want jobs or they're not looking for jobs. And as long as you can take millions and millions of people who are not working, even though they should be working, these are not people who are retiring because they have so much money they don't have to work. These are young people who should be in the workforce but either can't work or won't work, right? And they're just living on some government alternative, right? As long as we're not going to count them, then we're just deluding ourselves. But meanwhile, the labor force keeps shrinking, the tax base keeps shrinking. You have fewer and fewer people working to pay the taxes and to pay the benefits to all the people who aren't working, who are just collecting a check from the government.
Why don't you tell folks about what's going on at Euro-Pacific Capital?
Well, you know, we're just trying to spread the truth to our clients and our prospects, give them an alternative view and investment strategy than what they're getting from the mainstream establishment. You know, we're not, you know, spreading the lie of this rosy U.S. economy. We're not telling people to mindlessly buy overpriced, you know, social media stocks. People have to understand what the fundamentals are. We're helping our clients build global portfolios, buy the right stocks in the right countries with the right currencies. We do managed accounts. I manage my mutual funds. We do brokerage accounts specializing in international stocks. You can find out about it by talking to the brokers at Euro-Pacific Capital. You know, the website is europac.net. Peter Schiff, my gold company, Euro-Pacific Precious Metals. Actually, we're changing the name to Schiff Gold. Our website is schiffgold.com, where we sell physical gold and silver at very, very low markups. None of this, you know, huge markups on numismatics, just real low markups, just barely above spot price for coins and bars, which people need to buy. And, you know, and of course, I mentioned my gold fund. You can check, you can buy that anywhere, too, by the way. If you have an account at Schwab or Fidelity, you don't have to have an account with Euro-Pacific. You can buy the Euro-Pacific gold fund in your discount brokerage account or wherever you happen to be. And don't forget about my radio show, because I am talking about this stuff myself 5 days a week, right? Every Monday through Friday, shiftradio.com. You know, if we're not on a radio station in your area, and if, you know, we're not, you can always, you know, call up those radio stations and ask them to take the Peter Schiff show. But in the meantime, you can go to shiftradio.com and just listen whenever you want. The live show is 10 a.m. to noon Eastern. If you want to call in, then you want to listen live. But you can listen online anytime. We loop the show constantly, you know, between shows. And you can even become a premium member, which means you can listen to any show you want, anytime you want, this week's, last week's, last year. And we rip out all the commercials, so you can listen to it a lot quicker, and you can skip to the parts that you like or if you have a particular interview. So there's a lot of benefits to being a premium member.
Peter Schiff, thanks for joining us today. We'll look forward to talking to you again in 2014.
Hey, anytime.
It's a pleasure to welcome back James Turk, who has just released a new book. He's the co-author of The Money Bubble. Welcome back, James Turk.
Thanks, Chris.
10 years ago, you published The Coming Collapse of the Dollar with John Rubino, warning readers to take profits on real estate and direct them into gold. And anyone who took your advice certainly benefited handsomely. In The Money Bubble, you note that by avoiding the true problem, governments printing mountains of money and stimulus fiat-related money, the global central bankers have set the stage for yet another even larger crisis of epic proportions. Let me let you tell folks about your latest book.
Yeah, The Money Bubble, What to Do Before It Pops. You know, John and I started working on it early last year, and it's just now been published. In the coming collapse of the dollar, we expected that ultimately the dollar itself, would not only collapse against gold, but basically collapse as a means of currency. And, the gold price rose, the financial bust occurred, the housing bust occurred just as we expected it to. But because of all of this money printing in 2008, literally trillions and trillions of money printing, they managed to pump it up one more time to keep the system going, even though the system itself is terribly broken. So what we decided to do, particularly as the gold price was sliding last year, is to reevaluate all of the basic assumptions, go back and analyze every key point, and put it together to see whether we were still on the main road. And basically, we've concluded that, yes, the problems are there. They haven't been solved. The money printing has basically just kicked the can a little bit further down the road, but, now we're at the cliff, and I think we're very, very close to what we expected in 2008 to happen here in the not-too-distant future. And basically what we're expecting is that, all of this debt that's been put onto an already over-debt-laden financial system, it's just killing economic activity, and it has to be addressed. It wasn't addressed in 2008, and it has to be addressed now. The low interest rates have managed to keep the system going a little bit longer, but you're destroying capital by keeping interest rates so low, and that is falling on the backs of savers and the middle class because there are no alternatives to save currencies anymore. People have to own physical gold and physical silver, which is ultimately what I think is going to be returned as currency when this final bubble, the money bubble, finally pops.
It's already a classic because you discuss the worst case scenario where the global system implodes and what you're referring to as a new Great Depression that's worse than the recent Great Recession of 2008. Could you tell listeners why you expect a crack-up boom and the end of fiat money?
Basically, we've been on this path for 100 years, since the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, where the dollar slowly gets debased, its purchasing power gets eroded. And if you go back and look throughout monetary history, whenever you're on that kind of path, eventually the currency collapses. There are no exceptions. And the reason why the currency collapses is that inevitably people lose confidence in the currency when it's not backed by anything of substance, and that's exactly what's happening now. You're seeing confidence eroding in institutions, as we discussed in the book. You're seeing confidence eroding in the banks. And ultimately it's impacting the currency, and the currency is critical, Chris, because you need a sound currency for economic activity. The role of the government should be basically to maintain a level playing field, and one key element of maintaining a level playing field is to have a currency that everybody can deal with on a fair and equitable basis. But what's happened since 2008 particularly is the playing field has been tilted in favor of special interests. And as a consequence, that's why you're seeing so many protests around the world and why economic activity around the world is doing so poorly. The currency is not working the way it should be working.
Under the scenario that you've outlined in the book, the value of many paper assets, such as equities and even sovereign debt like treasuries, could evaporate. Please outline the dangers posed by the money bubble to the typical investor.
When you talk about wealth, it really comes in two different forms. You have a tangible wealth. Things like farmland, timberland, oil wells, gold mines, or mines of all sorts, houses, that's a tangible wealth that has real substance to it.
The other kind of wealth is financial wealth, you know, promises to pay. You know, if you deposit money in the bank promises to pay money back when you want it or when you need it. Or if you have an insurance policy, the insurance policy promises to make good on that insurance policy should the terms of the policy be triggered. But all of these forms of financial wealth are based on what's called counterparty risk. In other words, you're deferring your own purchasing power, the ability to acquire real tangible assets, accepting financial wealth in exchange for some kind of return based on someone's promise. And during periods of financial bust, and that's, you know, what we've been basically going through for several years now, and we're still going through it, promises are broken. And so the key to protect yourself during these periods is to hold tangible assets and to avoid, where possible, financial assets. In other words, avoid promises. And money has become nothing but a promise these days. It's not backed by anything anymore. And when the debt loads of governments become too big, they just print more money, until ultimately the currency itself is destroyed. And we're right now, I think, very close to that point, where confidence in the currency is declining. It's starting to accelerate, in my view. And as a consequence, the currency itself will cease to exist. And that's going to disrupt economic activity. But I want to make a key point, Chris. What we're providing in the book is a lot of useful information. Everybody can take that information and look at it and understand more about the financial system and gain our perspective. And then they have to make a decision as to what they need to do to prepare for some uncertainty in the months and years ahead. And we think one of the key elements is, aside from the strategy of accumulating tangible assets of all sorts, you have to accumulate the most liquid tangible asset, which, after all, is what money is in a society. It's the most liquid tangible assets. And by that, of course, I'm meaning gold and silver, physical gold and physical silver.
You know, the term martial law, I think, is thrown around so regularly in the blogosphere that sometimes it loses credibility. You also bring up this topic, and it's an interesting one. I wonder if you could outline the threat of a police state and its implications.
Yeah, you know, we're moving toward what everybody calls financial repression. You know, financial repression comes in many different forms. It comes by government control of interest rates. It comes in terms of capital controls. I mean, it's very difficult now for a U.S. citizen to open a bank account anywhere in the world because of the various forms of financial suppression being followed by the U.S. government already. But what happens is, when a currency no longer works, rather than acknowledging that there's a defect in the currency itself, governments resort to financial repression, and that becomes more and more severe, and that continues to impair economic activity. The trends are there. The writing is on the wall. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why we're concluding that, you know, people have to take steps to prepare for some tough times ahead, you know, like we saw in 2008, but probably going to be worse, because this time there's no opportunity to print more money to solve the problem. You cannot get out of a debt problem, which is what we have in the United States today, by taking on more debt. Politicians refuse to acknowledge that reality.
Each week we read of new restrictions placed on investors and businesses interested in moving funds offshore. You've already touched on this. I wonder if you would outline specific concerns that you have about impending capital controls.
One of the things that happens in countries, if you look back in monetary history, is that they try to make it more and more difficult for the citizens to do what they want with their money. A good example is what's going on in Argentina now, where they're making it very difficult for Argentinians to purchase goods and services online. It's another form of financial repression. And, you know, we live in a world that's uncertain. You know, nobody can predict the future. We don't know what's coming. So what every individual has to do is to take some steps that enables them to feel comfortable that, regardless what happens in the future, they and their families, you know, are protected. And I think one of the key elements to achieve that objective is to diversify one's assets in as many ways as possible, not only the types of assets, but where those assets are actually placed. In other words, diversify internationally in addition to diversifying into different types of assets. I think the key to get through what we've got coming is to diversify yourself as much as possible, and to do it with a global international view. And it can be done in a variety of different ways, you know, some of which we discuss in the money bubble.
In your new book, you discuss the dangers posed by barely extant banking system. Could you tell us how central banks may have taken over the world?
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious to most people, you know, that central banks and banking in generally, you know, has taken control, you know, of governments. You know, after the 2008 financial crisis, when the big bailouts were being proposed, the bailouts of the banking system, you know, I saw polls of the American people were saying that 80% were against it. But, you know, the bailouts were done anyway, despite the fact that the majority of the people were against it. So it shows that the people are disconnected from government. You know, government is not really doing what the people want. Government today is doing what the bankers want. And what the bankers want is not, it may be good for Wall Street, but it's not necessarily good for Main Street. And I think that's the issue that not just the United States, but pretty much the world is facing, because the central bankers have basically, and banking in general, have basically tilted that what's supposed to be a level playing field, they've tilted it into their favor.
The rise of Bitcoin caught many investors off guard. Gold Money and Gold Seek Radio were both early, though, in this trend. We added a Bitcoin payment system when the digital currency was trading around $5. It subsequently soared to about $1,000. However, you're concerned that some of these cryptocurrencies could present substantial risk to investors.
Yeah, you know, I think the term cryptocurrencies and, you know, what they encompass is a brilliant innovation. And I think they are definitely here to stay. And Bitcoin is the most predominant. It has the first mover advantage. You know, whether a new cryptocurrency will emerge a few months down the road and take market share away from Bitcoin, you know, only time will tell. There are a lot of different currencies out there that are trying to develop this new technological innovation that these currencies offer. But, you know, like anything else, you know, when you're going to be investing or spending your money, you have to do a certain amount of investigation and make sure that you're comfortable with this particular, you know, investment or particular currency. I personally believe that Bitcoin has a future, or cryptocurrencies have a future, but, you know, everybody has to look at it very carefully before they take any steps in that direction.
You caution folks to avoid debt and pay off existing obligations, yet you also are expecting runaway inflation. I wonder if you could tell investors why they should be paying off their debts when it's possible that inflation could wipe the debt slate clean.
Yeah, well, you know, this question is tied to the one we were previously talking about in terms of the bankers. You know, it's very easy for the bankers to have the rules rewritten that if the dollar does collapse and a new currency emerges, that the debt has to be repaid not in the old currency that collapsed, but in the new currency that represents the fair value of the asset, securing the debt, or, you know, just some fair value based on, you know, how prices have moved, in order to represent some kind of equity back to the bank. And what John and I discuss in the book is what happened to Thomas Jefferson, you know, the author of the Declaration of Independence. He died poor because he ended up having to pay the debt on his father-in-law's estate twice. He paid it first in terms of the local currency during the War of Independence. He put the money with the Virginia government, but the currency was destroyed. And he ended up having to repay the debt a second time after the war ended in British pounds. And, of course, at the time, the British pound was on a gold standard. And having to pay the debt the second time, you know, nearly bankrupted him, and he ended up basically a pauper when he died. So you can't assume that just because you have debt that the banks are going to let you repay that debt in a currency that collapses. And we think the safest way to play this is to avoid debt altogether and just own tangible assets free and clear without any debt obligations.
Well, that's the best explanation I've heard in the 8 years we've been on the show, so hat tip for that. Chapter 22, you offer the case for $10,000 gold. Lofty target, and listeners are going to want to know why.
Yeah, well, you know, if anybody's been following my work over the years, you know, back at the beginning of in 2001, when I first founded Gold Money, and, you know, the gold price was around $300 an ounce, I was saying that over the next 12, actually between 2013 and 2015, we were going to be up around $8,000 an ounce. You know, we've gone from 300 to up to 2,000, back a little bit, but we still have the big move yet to come. And maybe my timing's going to be wrong, but all of the mechanical and mathematical formulas that I use to value gold, which John and I discuss in detail in the book, suggest that we're really looking now at a price over $10,000 per ounce. What's happened from the time when I first made that forecast to the present is the target has moved higher for the simple reason that the dollar itself has been debased so badly by all of the new debt and the various policies that are being followed by the Federal Reserve. So we've had to move the goalposts, a little bit further down the field to account for all of that dollar debasement. So we're ultimately lay out the reasons as to why we're in a bubble, why people don't truly understand today what money really is, and this is all explained in the book, and why gold will reemerge not only as money, but also as a form of currency. It's money today in the sense that, when you have money, you can do two things with it, Chris. You can either spend it or you can save it. And there's an old principle in monetary theory called Gresham's Law. It was set up by the advisor to Elizabeth I in the United Kingdom. He said basically bad money drives out good. In other words, you save the good money and you spend the bad money. And that's what's happening today with gold. People buy it and accumulate it and save it, and we're forced to use these bad currencies, which are the national currencies. And ultimately, you're going to see the national currencies go the way they always do go, which is they collapse, and gold and silver will reemerge as currency in some form in the future. Maybe a combination of a Bitcoin, gold, silver, digital cryptocurrency, we just don't know. We don't know how the technology is going to take it. We don't know what politicians are going to try to do to fight to maintain the status quo where the banks have a disadvantage, have the advantage to the disadvantage of American citizen. So all you can do is sort of, take it day by day, but you have to plan now as best you possibly can for an uncertain future. And I always keep coming back to physical gold and physical silver, accumulating that savings. But the point is that savings are important for everybody, but you can't save national currency because you don't earn interest income to offset the risk of those currencies. What you really need to do is save physical metal because you're saving purchasing power for a rainy day or to purchase a consumer good or the plan for your retirement. The precious metals are the way to go for that, to achieve those strategies in a safe, proven way.
Investors typically think of poor man's gold, silver, as just a less expensive play on the yellow metal gold. But last week we saw gold explode higher. Bad news, manufacturing news from China dampened the prospects for industrial metals, so silver actually sagged as gold shot up significantly higher on the weaker dollar, among other factors. I wonder if you might explain to folks why the case for $100 silver could be a bit different than the gold story.
Yeah, gold is money. That's where most of its value comes from. It doesn't come from its use in industry. It comes from the fact that it's very useful in economic calculation to measure the prices of goods and services. Silver, on the other hand, has value for two different reasons. It has an industrial component, but it also has a monetary component. And this monetary component I call it a gold substitute. Right now it takes about 64 ounces of silver to equal 1 ounce of gold. Well, if you own 64 ounces of silver instead of 1 ounce of gold, those 64 ounces of silver do the same thing for you in the sense that you have money, physical money, outside the banking system with no counterparty risk. Now, as you go through a financial crisis, people start to look for alternatives. Obviously, they're going to move into gold, but silver is cheap relative to gold because right now the ratio is 64, but during normal times it should be closer to 20 or lower, 20 ounces of silver to equal 1 ounce of gold or lower than that. So over the next several years, my expectation is that silver is going to do even better than gold does, but you have to remember silver is much more volatile than gold, and so consequently it may not be for everybody.
I wonder if you could tell people more about this excellent Money Bubble book. I have a copy here. I highly recommend the digital copy. And by the way, thank you for that. It's a wonderful read, and everybody's going to want a copy on their desktop and probably a hard copy as well. You can download right now from Amazon.com. Can you tell folks any other contact information or whatever's new at goldmoney.com?
Basically, you can order the Money Bubble, What to Do Before It Pops. Amazon. It's also available in local bookstores. If your local store doesn't have it, it can be ordered through the local store because it is being distributed just like all other books are being distributed. We hope that people find it, you know, useful as they try to deal with the difficult circumstances, economic and monetary circumstances that we live in today. You can find more information about the book at John Rubino's, my co-author, his website, dollarcollapse.com. And I've also written some information about it on goldmoney.com. I hope people find it a very useful and informative book. Thank you, Chris.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with conquerchange.com. A figure-ground relationship is an interesting psychological illustration that shows how the mind can perceive the background of an image as the foreground, and by the same token, perceive the foreground of an image as the background, thereby changing the emphasis of what our mind believes is important and what is not. The classic example most people are familiar with is the profile image of two faces looking at each other. But when you stare at the image long enough, those two faces can also be interpreted as a vase for flowers. The dark outline of the two faces have a white space between them, that is the shape of a flower vase. The mind does battle between these two shapes. Some people see two faces. Some people see the flower vase. It's often difficult to distinguish between the two, because the edge that would separate the foreground from the background is really part of neither. It equally defines both of them. If you want to see examples of these kinds of images, go to Google Images and search for figure ground. The mechanism by which a figure-ground image misdirects and confuses the mind is important to understand, because it is a similar mechanism that allows the mind to confuse fact for fiction, and fiction for fact, when prompted by the right suggestion or misinformation. Those who want to push gold into the background and diminish its role as the primary competition to all paper fiat currencies, when in fact gold is asserting itself in the foreground of the marketplace, understand this process, and use rhetoric and outright financial propaganda to accomplish their task. A MarketWatch article this week quoted Paul Nolte, managing director of Dearborn Partners, who said, "Gold is just seeing a brief bounce after its big drop last year." He said, "This is a one-day type of event," and went on to say, "Over the longer term, we'll see a general trend lower." Of course, Mr. Nolte was speaking on a panel discussing gold hosted by ETF.com. It was reported the general consensus on this panel is that the view for gold going forward wasn't that enthusiastic. To reinforce this point of view, the panel said this coincides with the downbeat forecasts of late from many big banks on the metal. Let's see. With the exception of a handful of Canadian gold ETFs that actually have the metal they claim to have in allocated accounts, the rest of the ETFs don't have the gold they pretend to have. The fine print of their prospectuses indicate their ETFs will track the price of gold. It's a confidence game. If ETFs keep telling the public they have gold, unfortunately, many will believe them. The fact that a few giant investors are able to withdraw physical gold from ETFs creates the illusion there is physical gold in those ETFs for the smaller investor, when in fact, there is not. Of course, the big bank's sentiment is that gold is going down long term. Not that it is, mind you, only that they want it to. Because gold is direct competition to all paper financial instruments. And in the ultimate showdown between paper and metal, metal wins. Add to that that employees at big banks who are short gold and silver are mysteriously falling off rooftops this week. All this in addition to the fact we are fast approaching a force majeure situation on the COMEX because physical gold for delivery is at historic lows. ETFs, big banks, and the COMEX are regularly quoted as the go-to sources of gold information. The fact is, these institutions are at the heart of the war that has been waged against gold since the invention of Robert Rubin's alleged strong dollar policy in the early 1990s. The only mechanism to the strong dollar policy has been a methodical, long-term assault on the yellow metal to give cover to a constantly inflating money supply, an assault that gold has managed to fend off without breaking much of a sweat. The dollar and other paper fiat currencies are starting to break a sweat. True, the dollar may temporarily appreciate against other fiat currencies, because the dollar is still the best-looking horse in the glue factory. But all those horses are ultimately going to be sacrificed. As I have stated before, I believe we will reach a point where there will be a showdown between the dollar and gold. At that point, the dollar will collapse, and gold will achieve breakout velocity well into five figures. Or, there will be a shotgun wedding, where the dollar and gold will be reunited in a forced matrimony, reinstating some kind of new gold standard. Or at least, the perception of one. When the bond market bubble, the stock market bubble, the debt bubble, and the new real estate bubble all begin to collapse in unison, like the Twin Towers falling on 9/11, that's when you should put your ear to the ground and listen carefully for wedding bells. Chris, on February 21st and 22nd, I'll be speaking at the second annual Liberty Mastermind Symposium in Las Vegas with 15 speakers, three panel discussions on one amazing day. Details are on my website, and until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.